Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on compulsory education when we come back. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And if you can't afford him, then my second choice would be you. That's right. And that's because you are the best guy to represent your interests in court. After all, you were there, and you did it or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know what was said, you know who said it, you know who is lying, and you know who is telling the truth. You know, but your lawyer does not know, and he doesn't know any more than you tell him. And besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. The abhorrence of the legal profession is documented throughout Anglo-Saxon history. Shakespeare's Dick the Butcher in King Henry VI exclaimed, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Dickens wrote, "If there were no bad people, there would be no good lawyers." Poor Richard, in his almanac, said, "God works wonders now and then. Behold, a lawyer, an honest man." So scorned were lawyers by the colonists that they were depicted as lawyer birds with their long bills and lawyer fish, always slippery. Both Massachusetts and Rhode Island prohibited lawyers from serving in their colonial assemblies. Brigham Young, upon establishing his utopia in the Utah desert, characterized lawyers as a stink in the nostrils of every Latter-day Saint, and described the courtroom as a cage of unclean birds, a den and kitchen of the devil. Now, early in the 19th century, the Baptist preacher John Leland attacked a host of lawyers who infest our land like the swarms of locusts in Egypt and eat up every green thing. Well, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment and three rules, and they are: don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's free. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, and it's informative. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right off the computer. All right, we've been talking about this thing of compulsory education. Compulsory education, that is, compelled to do something. You are being compelled to educate your children in public school. After all, it's the law. I pointed out to you that that law actually got started a long time before the federal government here in the United States got into the education business. It started with Moses at Mount Sinai. Moses at Mount Sinai came down off the mountain with 10 commandments written on two tables of stone. But he also came down with parchment, and the parchment went into the Ark of the Covenant, and it contained all of the laws, all of the statutes, judgments, and commandments that God instructed Moses to write down, to teach the children of Israel. So in the final analysis, then, this concept of education, that is, compulsory education, comes from the creator of the universe himself, live and direct. And he backed that up with seven statutes. I showed you where those were located. And those seven statutes served us well until the 1930s, and the federal government got involved in education starting in 1937 in the Roosevelt administration. But compulsory education by governments and government institutions isn't something new. It goes clear back into ancient times, ancient Babylon and Assyria and Egypt. Those people all recognized the value of a state-sponsored public education. It doesn't have anything to do with education per se. It has to do with loyalty to the state and control of the people by the state. Now, in its modern form, compulsory education goes back to Otto von Bismarck. And one of the major world arenas in which Hegelian philosophy and materialistic anti-psychology of wont has been applied is that of education. Now, in 1819 in Prussia, the first compulsory schooling for children was instituted. And according to educator John Taylor Gatto, society in Prussia was divided into children who will become policymakers and children who will become assistants to those policymakers. The assistants to the policymakers are the professionals, like the engineers, the architects, the lawyers, and the doctors. And the children who will be the vast massed used. They're called the proletariat. Now, Prussia set up a three-tier school system in which one-half of 1% of the population was taught to think. They go to a school called Akademie. 5.5% of the population go to real schooling, where they partially learn to think, but not completely. And that's because Prussia believed that their defeat at the hands of Napoleon was caused by people thinking for themselves at times of stress on the battlefield. And they were going to see to it that scientifically this couldn't happen. The lowest 94%, and that's some pyramid, isn't it? The lowest 94% of the population went to Volksschulen, where they were to learn harmony, obedience, freedom from stressful thinking, and how to follow orders. They worked out a system that would, in fact, guarantee such results. And in the Volksschulen, it was to divide whole ideas, which really simultaneously participate in math, science, social thinking, language, and art, into subjects which hardly had existed before, to divide the subjects further into units, and to divide the time into small enough units of time, when enough variations in the course of the day, no one would know what was going on. In the middle of the last century, a member of the secret Skull and Bone Society, following in the Prussian tradition, set in motion here in America educational revolutions that have subverted the entire system toward the goals of the New World Order. And that man was Daniel Coit Gilman. He was the first president of Johns Hopkins University and of the Carnegie Institution. Gilman studied Hegelian philosophy at the University of Berlin in 1854 and 1855, and also at the University of Berlin. And during this time was the earlier mentioned Wilhelm Wundt, who was key in applying Hegelian-styled psychology to the world. Gilman came from a family of bonesmen, and after he returned from Germany in 1856, he became treasurer of Skull and Bones. Simultaneously, Gilman became assistant librarian at Yale and was appointed to the position of head librarian 2 years later. During the same period, Skull and Bones covertly took over the administration of Yale University with the presidency of the school from that period forward and turned over to a succession of Illuminized bonesmen. That's according to the Iconoclast of October 13, 1873. Now, they have obtained control of Yale. Its business is performed by them. Money paid to the college must pass into their hands and be subject to their will. Keep in mind now that Woodrow Wilson was from Yale, and as was George Bush. Skull and Bonesmen, they are. Now, no doubt they are worthy men in themselves, but the many whom they looked down upon while in college cannot so far forget as to give money freely into their hands. That's men in Wall Street complain that the college comes straight to them for help instead of asking each graduate for his share. The reason is found in a remark made by one of Yale's and America's first men. Few will give but bones men, and they care far more for their society than they do for the college. It's called the Woolsey Fund. The Woolsey Fund has put a has but a struggling existence for kindred reasons. Here, then, appears the true reason for Yale's poverty. Yale is controlled by a few men who shut themselves off from others and assume to be their superiors. Now, Gilman met with Frederick T. Gates, who ran the Rockefeller Foundation, and he implored him to set up the Southern Educational Board, merging the Slatter and Peabody funds. Gilman called the foundation the General Education Board, signaling his intentions. The organization was later renamed the Rockefeller Foundation. Gilman was the first president of Johns Hopkins University, and he carefully chose for the faculty members from the Skull and Bones and other groups of the Hegelian stripe. And among those was G. Stanley Hall, the first of Wundt's American students to make a mark. Hall's training in Leipzig was paid for by a loan from a member of Scroll and Key, a sister society to Skull and Bones at Yale. In Leipzig, Hall immersed himself in Hegelian-inspired psychological studies, taught by materialist psychologists like Hartmann, Helmholtz, and his greatest influence, Wundt. Then, returning to America in 1883, he took over the psychological laboratory of the new Johns Hopkins and started the American Psychological Association and the American Journal of Psychology. And, according to Hall, the psychology that I taught was almost entirely experimental and covered for the first or the most part the material that Wundt had set forth in the latter and larger edition of Psychological Psychology. In 1889, Hall was chosen as the first president of the newly established Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hall was the mentor of one of the most influential names in American education of his century. His name was John Dewey. Now, Dewey studied under Hall at Johns Hopkins, moving on to teach at the universities of Michigan and Minnesota. Another major influence upon Dewey was the Hegelian philosopher George Morris, who had received his doctorate from the University of Berlin. And according to Dewey, echoing the sentiments of his Prussian mentors, there is no God, and there is no soul. There are no needs for the props of traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or permanent moral absolutes. That's the heart and core of public education. Let me repeat it. There is no God, and there is no soul. and there are no needs for props of traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or permanent moral absolutes. That's why we have these 17 major problems in public school today. That's the exact reason why. We used to worry about talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, and not putting paper in the wastebaskets. That came from moral absolutes. That came from a time when we used the Bible and God and the Ten Commandments as the basis for morality. Beginning in the 1960s, though, we expunged God, the Bible, prayer, and morality from our public schools. And now, the number one problem in public school is rape, followed by robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, and murder. The top seven problems in public school today: rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, and murder, followed by absenteeism, suicide, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, premarital pregnancy, abortions, and venereal disease. Now, I would submit that most people would not want their children subjected to any of these 17 problems, which are the top problems in public schools today. Who would send his child to be raped, robbed, assaulted, burgled, burned, bombed, or murdered? I can't think of anybody. But public school is the place to have those crimes committed against your children. I pointed out to you earlier that here in the book, it's called America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. He pointed out that there were 180 shootings a year in Detroit. That is, children shooting other children, not necessarily on the school grounds now, but children. It's just high school, or in some cases, grade school children shooting other children. 180 times, that's one a day for every day of school in Detroit. Now, you can rest assured that the problem is the same in Philadelphia, Richmond, California, Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. It isn't something that just occurs in Detroit. Now, what causes this? It's the anti-God, anti-morality that's been introduced into the public school system. And after all, it's the best place to put that kind of psychology or that kind of education. It's into a compulsory education system controlled by these wicked and evil people. Just that simple. It's no big mystery. Now, why don't you have these problems in homeschool? Why don't you have these problems in parochial school? Because you still have the Ten Commandments. You still have morality. You still have right and wrong and absolutes. Now, Dewey published the first American textbook on Hegelian philosophy as applied to the Wundt psychological innovations in his book, Psychology. In 1895, he joined the faculty at the Rockefeller-funded University of Chicago, heading the philosophy, psychology, and teaching departments and establishing an education laboratory called the Dewey School, later known as the Laboratory School of the University of Chicago. So there's where the thing got started and how it's been operated here in the United States. It's quite a little story. Now, I'm not here to tell you not to educate your child in public school. After all, you were probably educated in public school. I was. I'm a product of the public school system. I'm still recovering from it, doing my best. Now, let's take a look at public school from an administrative point of view. And that is, one problem with policymakers is that they insist upon making policy, and perhaps nowhere is this more of a problem than in public education. A recent study by Common Good of laws and regulations that affect a typical New York City high school is the latest example. The study found more than 60 sources of law and regulations, including thousands of provisions applying to a New York City high school. These include New York State's more than 800-page school law, 720 pages of regulations from the State Commissioner of Education, more than 15,000 decisions contained in 43 volumes of the Commissioner's Office, the 204-page teacher union contract with the district, and nearly 700-page No Child Left Behind Act, and more than 200 pages of regulations just concerning student discipline. Now, boys and girls, that's 17,624 pages of material that regulate New York City High School. 17,624 pages. Let's see how many 300-page books that would be. 17,624 divided by 300 pages in a typical book. That's 59 books. 59 books that every New York City school administrator and school teacher would have to read, know, and understand in order to follow all the rules and regulations. And that's just for New York City. Los Angeles will have its own, Detroit will have its, and Philadelphia will have theirs, and so on down the line. Now, this isn't done for no good reason. It's done with specificity. What's going on in the public schools isn't an accident. It's not the natural results of just innocent people doing what they believed was best for your child, and it just somehow got out of control. It was a carefully contrived plan to dumb your child down. And then Charlotte Isherby wrote a book called, let's see if I can remember, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. If you're sending your child to public school, it's with the intention of deliberately turning out a dunce, dumbing him down, sending him to real schooling so that he will never be able to think for himself. That's the purpose behind it. 65 steps are involved in suspending a disruptive student. 83 steps are involved in firing a teacher. 38 steps are involved in filling a teacher vacancy. And 99 steps are involved in replacing a heating system. Another 99 steps in conducting an athletic event, including the size of ear flaps. And 35 steps in suspending a special education student. Some of these procedures can take years to resolve. Even then, such as an attempt to fire a teacher, it may cost more than $100,000 and still not be successful. Now, just imagine trying to run your business like that. Let's suppose that you're running, well, let's say an auto repair shop, and you have 5-6 mechanics working in your shop, and one of your mechanics is incompetent, and you want to fire him. You need to get rid of him. You need to replace this guy with somebody else, somebody that you can place your confidence in. But you're faced with 17,624 pages of rules. It could cost you $100,000 to get rid of this guy, and it may not be successful. Can you see what the dilemma is? See what the problem is? Now, in Washington, D.C., there's a woman there by the name of Ree who's been given the job of turning the city around. She has to deal with the union. It's not like it is in business, where if you have non-performing or unproductive people working for you, you just fire them. You can't do that. So once you have an incompetent teacher in position, you can't get rid of them. Well, you know, virtually you can't get rid of them. Now, that's problem number one. Now, as a parent, as a homeschooler, you can fire all of the pedophiles and incompetent teachers in your public school system. You can jerk your kid out of public school tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock and educate him at home. The law provides for that. That's assuming, of course, that you would want to educate your child. Most people don't want to. They don't mind pumping them out, but they don't want to educate them. They don't want the responsibility after that. Now, New York State isn't alone. We're at the top of the list in bureaucratic complexities. Indiana's school code at 1,250 pages a few years ago is more than 50% longer than New York's. California has more than 9,000 pages, and its 11 volumes are said to weigh more than 40 pounds. It includes such essential details as stipulating football uniforms be sterilized at least once a year, and districts may use armored vehicles to transport money to banks, and prohibiting parents from helping paint or clean public schools without union permission. Again, this is, it's purely economics. If you think about it, what would be wrong with parents volunteering to come clean up the graffiti? What would be wrong with parents coming into the school to help paint or do? No, you can't do that. They've got a union over here, and that union contract comes into play, which has nothing to do with your child's education. The union contract with the school teachers, the union contract with the janitors or the mechanics that work on the school, it deals with education and monopoly for those unions and for those employees. And they couldn't give a rat's, you know what, for the education of your child. Now, that's just where reality is located, so we might as well wake up and smell a coffee. Now, it's been reported that Pennsylvania suburban school district superintendents must comply with 1,027 mandates, 70% of which are unfunded. And a few years ago, the Ohio governor, George Voinovich, said school administrators in that state spend as much as 50% of their time filling out federal forms, which account for only 6% of the education spending. Now, the U.S. Department of Education itself has said its requirements result in 48.6 million hours of paperwork annually, the equivalent of 25,000 full-time employees. So the federal government comes into play, and this is a bureaucratic nightmare. And it's been created all in the best interests of your children to educate your child or to dumb him down, depending upon which side of the fence you're on. We're here to make sure this kid's not able to think for himself, and therefore he can be manipulated. And then, of course, parents, they want to educate their child and give them the best possible education, whatever education is. And I'm not really sure that everybody's in agreement as to what education really is or what it should be composed of. Now, in the Bible, God is pretty emphatic about education, and he says that he wants everybody to have a legal education, and he wants everybody to be educated at home by his parents, Now, that isn't the only education you get. There's also the Levitical and the Aaronic priests. They come into play, and they've got an educational role. Government comes into play. The king has an educational role. There's other places for people to learn things, and, of course, then there's a technical education. Let me describe that for you. There was a time here in America, in fact, in England, in Anglo-Saxon administration, where we taught people to be mechanics, farriers, carpenters, stonemasons, plumbers. They didn't go to community college. They were apprenticed out, and we still have that in our trade unions. We have a program where you know, a young fellow, he's 16 years old, let's say. He decides he doesn't want to go to college. He doesn't want to be a professional. He wants to be a carpenter. So he apprentices himself to a master carpenter. And he works for 4 years in the trades. This is hands-on. In fact, I was watching This Old House the other day. And This Old House, the television production, hired a young fellow. He was in trade school. And This Old House television program, they needed somebody to work there. And so they hired this kid as an apprentice. And he's working for Tom Silva on the program. And the young fellow said, God, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. I got to tell you, I think the kid's right. It is. That guy is going to learn from the masters and the pros of the masters and pros how to do everything in remodeling old houses. I mean, that kid, when he gets through, you know, in 4 years' time, that kid's going to be a carpenter. He'll be a plumber and an electrician at the same time. He'll learn all of those skills in his apprenticeship as a carpenter. And when he gets through, then he becomes what's known as a journeyman. Now, a guy who's a journeyman, you know, we would ask him, well, where did you learn the craft? Where did you learn the trade? Well, I learned it from old Bob over here. I learned it from old Bill over here. Now, when I was a kid, if you had worked for Frank Rocha, you know, in the valley, we all knew Frank Rocha. We knew John Enos and Bill Trutelli and Francis Capini. And if you had spent time working on those ranches, if you had learned livestock, if you had learned dairying from Francis Capini, by golly, we knew that you knew something. And that's where your credentials come in. I studied at the feet of Gamaliel. That's the Apostle Paul. He was tutored. He had a law school education, and he studied law at the feet of a master lawyer, a master in the law. His name was Gamaliel. And there were your credentials. You didn't say, well, I went to Harvard or Yale. And the problem with these major institutions is, you know, well, I went to Yale. I went to Harvard. Well, that's fine. But you were a cookie cutter. You were cut out of thousands of other students just like you. And you were put through a regimen. And then when you got through, you passed all your tests. That doesn't mean that you know anything or that you've got good skills. It means you passed all of your tests, and you've got a piece of paper that stamps you approved like a cookie cutter. When you're trained as a carpenter, a plumber, or an electrician, or a lawyer, or a doctor, as a student of a tutor like Aristotle or Socrates, that means that you know something. If you were a student of Dr. Christopher, by golly, you know your craft. Hey, we're at the halfway point. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and the radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, for those of you that have a computer or you listen to us online, you can download that free general law CD package right off of our website at georgegordon.org. Go to our archives page. That's where you listen to this program. And on that archives page, you'll find this free general law CD. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, at least to the best of our knowledge and belief it is. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. And then finally, these opinions, these beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're discussing this thing of compulsory education. And there's a book that you should read. It's put out by a fellow named David Barton, David, B-A-R-T-O-N, America, To Pray or Not to Pray is the title of it. And it's most of the material comes from the Department of Education. Those are the sources, of course, but this story that I told you about, polls show they now list the top public school offenses as. They're talking about school violence and teachers' competency testing, things like that. This is information that's online. It comes right out of the Department of Education. You can verify the numbers that I'm giving you and the statements that I'm making. But first, you need the book itself. It's 12 bucks. It's paperback. It's less than 200 pages. It's 160 pages or so. Easy reading, well put together, statistically accurate, well referenced and documented. You know, if you've got a number on here and you say, well, where in the world did he get that number? And then you can go back and you can go online and go check with the Department of Education or with his source. You can get the newspaper article from the Dallas newspaper or somebody else. Barton has an outfit called the Wall Builder Press, Post Office Box 397. Aledo, Texas, A-L-E-D-O. I have no idea where Aledo, Texas is, but the zip code is 76008. Now remember, that's Wall Builder Press, Post Office Box 397, Aledo, Texas, 76008. Phone number is 817-441-6044. Once more, that's 817-441-6044. Last time I got a copy, it was 12 bucks. All right, let's take a look at a little something else here. I showed you this test the other day. There's one here called The Right Stuff. Let's take a look here at some successful homeschooled people. There's nothing, to my mind, that is more convincing than to actually talk to people or take a look at people who have actually done it. It's one thing to talk about it. It's something else to go walk a mile in that guy's moccasin. So here are some successful and famous people that have been homeschooled. I'll start off here with a set of twins here, Venus and Serena. They're Williams. They're tennis players, both of them. Venus Williams is a homeschooler that has back-to-back wins at Wimbledon, both in 2000 and 2001. By adding the Australia Open title to the French Open, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open crown she captured in 2002, Serena became the fifth player in history to hold all four championships at one time. Serena Williams at the Australian Open in 2003, both of them. Homeschooled. Both of them African Americans, by the way, for those of you out in the world that don't know. They're in the sports world. Here's another sports fellow by the name of Jason Taylor, also an African American. In the Pro Bowl, he was voted as a starter to the AFC Pro Bowl squad, the first such honor of his NFL career. Jason was homeschooled during high school, although he played sports for Woodland Hills High School in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jason worked with children's hospitals in Pittsburgh and Akron, has participated in events benefiting the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and the Miami Project to cure paralysis. He has assisted in building houses in Miami for Habitat for Humanity. Prior to the 1999 season, he released his own calendar with a portion of the proceeds going to benefit First Book, a national nonprofit organization committed to giving children the opportunity to read and to own their first few books. Each of the last 2 years has been a member of the Crunch on Paralysis team, along with Trace Armstrong and Zach Thomas, that made a donation for every sack and tackle they made to the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis. Okay, that young fellow's name is Jason Taylor. Dakota Fanning. In real life, this precious 8-year-old astonished a group of jaded reporters at Taken's Press Junket, when asked simplistic kitty questions about her work. Fanning responded with the articulation of a seasoned professional. So how did this child learn so much so fast? I'm homeschooled, and I have a teacher that goes with me on all of my movies. She's taught me a lot because I've had her since I was in second grade, and I'm in fourth grade right now. Dakota Fanning in Steven Spielberg's Taken is photographed here. If you'd like a copy of this email here, it's www.sherbradenton.homestead.com. That's www.sherbradenton, that's all one word, .homestead.com. And then /famous, and there are a number of people in here that are featured. These are just some of the movie stars. Josh Lane has been playing the harp for over a decade. He was homeschooled by his mother, Marty Lane. Now in his early 20s, Lane has become totally devoted to his instrument. Why? Well, some people are addicted to chocolate. I'm addicted to harp playing, he said. Jenna Malone, the talented actress that has starred and played prominent roles in several movies and TV shows. Let's see, who else is famous in here? Homeschooler Jenny Chansey was able to take advantage of the flexibility offered by homeschooling to learn how to sew. She says, my mother taught me to sew on the machine when I was 8. When I turned 14 and saw the Anne of Green Gables video series, I decided I wanted to learn to recreate vintage clothing for myself. My mother then spent a good part of my 8th grade year teaching me to make patterns from scratch and draping fabric on a sewing mannequin. So back when I was homeschooled in the early 80s, we didn't have online classes, let alone the internet. So I never had an opportunity to study that way. However, I now have the privilege of teaching students all over the world, including many homeschoolers, online through the costume classroom. It's been so much fun to interact with students interested in historical costuming, especially those who do not have sewing classes available locally. If you're wondering, of what value is something like this? Well, a person like that can go to Hollywood and get a job in a heartbeat, or go to Broadway and get a job in a heartbeat. All of those costumes that you see people wearing have to be made from scratch. You can't go down to John's Suit Shop and pick up a vintage 1865 suit when you want to play the role of Abraham Lincoln. Somebody has to actually make that suit and make that suit in the size of the actor. Now, I personally am not in the market for an 1865 vintage suit to play the role of Abraham Lincoln, but you know, those are the kinds of real life, on the job kinds of experiences and educations that people get. I would submit to you that that young woman there, homeschooled and taught to sew, is not unemployed and is not one of those standing in line, in an unemployment line, looking for a job. That woman can get a job anywhere she wants to work. As long as there's a theater out there, and as long as there are actors, and as long as there's a need, there's going to be employment for her. And as far as I can tell, Hollywood thrived during the 1930s. Now let's take a look at some other famous people. People like John Adams, second president of the United States. Joseph Pulitzer. Have you heard of the Pulitzer Prize in literature or in journalism? The Pulitzer Prize. Well, the founder of it, the guy Joseph Pulitzer, was homeschooled. Ansel Adams. He's either a photographer. I believe he was a photographer. If not, he was an artist. Ansel Adams. Robert Frost, an author. Irving Berlin, songwriter. Whoopi Goldberg, another African-American movie star. Jennifer Love Hewitt, the Hanson Singers. Jason Taylor and Todd Lodwick. I mentioned them already. Or Jason Taylor, I mentioned already. He's a football player. There's a fellow here named William F. Buckley, Jr. He put out a monthly news magazine. William F. Buckley was on television quite often. He had a weekly television show. He's a conservative political analyst. He's dead now, but he was a pretty famous fellow. Homeschool. And I never thought about how many of these famous people, or how many of the people that you see out here are homeschooled. Andrew Carnegie. Remember, he was the steel magnate from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Came from Scotland here to the United States, homeschooled. Charlie Chaplin, the movie star. Now, of course, today, you would not view Charlie Chaplin as being much, but back in the 1920s, when Charlie Chaplin was at the peak of his career, he was the top box office hit of his day. Probably the wealthiest movie star, probably got paid more in real terms and dollars than a movie star is getting paid today. Agatha Christie, the writer of Murder on the Orient Express, she wrote many murder mysteries. Winston Churchill, the leader of Great Britain during World War II, he had a long and distinguished political career. Charles Dickens, an author. Thomas Edison. Edison held over 1,200 patents. The thing that sets Edison apart from, I think, everybody else in this entire list, 1,200 patents. This is a guy that could think. And to illustrate my point, let me describe a little bit of his career. Edison didn't invent very much oven by himself. The electric light bulb was invented by a guy named Johnson. He was the guy that came up with the idea. He invented the process for making the vacuum tube. But he could not make the filament work in the light bulb. Edison paid him $100 for his work and his experiments. And then Edison went to work on the project. And then he worked on it long and hard. And he finally found an element that would sustain for 40 hours in a light bulb. And got the patent on it and got credit for inventing the electric light bulb. And Edison did that over and over again with the movie projector, the movie camera. He took ideas from other people. Edison could think. And he was a very, very crafty businessman. He applied himself and said, of what value is this after we have invented it? Even after we have created this, does it have any value? The people at Western Union were offered the telephone for $100,000, which I got to tell you, $100,000 back in the 1880s now was an awful lot of money. But for $100,000, they could have had the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell, who had invented it, came to Western Union and said, hey, listen, I'd like to sell this to you. You people are in the communications business, and I'd just like to make a quick score and get my money and get out. And Western Union said, no, we don't want it. It's a novelty. It isn't going anywhere. Nobody's gonna buy that. Western Union today is just about out of business. They're still operating. There's still a company called Western Union. They're limited just to wiring money. As far as I know, that's all they do is wire money back and forth. And if it wasn't for that, they would be history. But the telephone is still out there, isn't it? Now, it just goes to show you, Thomas Edison was able to look into the future with his inventions. He actually invented the concept of invention. He put a laboratory together. It was like Bell Laboratory. He was the first. He put a laboratory together, and he employed other inventors. Put them to work there. Gave them the money. And then, of course, when they would invent something, he owned it, didn't he? And that's what happens today at Bell Laboratories, for instance. You can be working for this corporation, Bell Telephone, but if you invent something while you're working for them, the invention belongs to Bell Laboratories. So Edison is the guy that pioneered that. Now, get this, he only went to the third grade. Benjamin Franklin, the guy that you see on the face of the $100 bill, homeschooled. Florence Nightingale, the woman that is the famous nurse. Woodrow Wilson, not anybody to brag about. Woodrow Wilson was the president that signed the Federal Reserve Act in 1914. Well, anyway, Woodrow Wilson was homeschooled. The Wright brothers, Wilbur and Orville Wright, the Wright brothers, homeschooled. Alexander Graham Bell, homeschooled, the inventor of the telephone. Now think about this for a minute. Here's a couple of very, very important inventions. The electric light bulb and the telephone, both of them created by homeschoolers. General George S. Patton, General Patton, the famous World War II general, homeschooled. Joan of Arc. Leonardo da Vinci, Wolfgang Mozart, Felix Mendelssohn. Now, these are pretty famous people, Joan of Arc, Leonardo da Vinci, Wolfgang Mozart, and Felix Mendelssohn, all homeschooled. Claude Monet, now that was a name that didn't come immediately to mind. I've heard that name before, French name, had to be some kind of a French poet, writer, politician. William Penn, that's the name Pennsylvania comes from, the governor. William Penn, Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, remember, the Rough Rider, President of the United States, Robert E. Lee, the commanding general of the Southern Forces, Douglas MacArthur, remember, he was the famous general that headed up the American effort in the Pacific War, World War II, C.S. Lewis, Hans Christian Andersen, Mark Twain, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, first president, Thomas Jefferson, third president, John Adams, second president, John Quincy Adams, our sixth president, all of these presidents now homeschooled. John Paul Jones, Patrick Henry. Have you got some of the most famous names here in American and British history were homeschooled. The concepts that people have today that if we didn't go to public school, you couldn't get into college. That's a fiction. All of the major colleges and universities have a special program for homeschool children, and that's because homeschool children score, on average now, at the 86th percentile. Now, I'm sure that there are some homeschool children that are just dumb as a box of rocks. There's just no way around that. But on average, they score higher than every other form of education. As a collective group, they score at the 86th percentile. Colleges and universities have special programs. They're looking for homeschool children. So when you put on your application that you are homeschooled, and if, in fact, you can pass the tests, you will be given a fast track into the college or university. You have a better chance of getting into that prestigious school that you'd like to get into being homeschooled than you do coming out of public school. Public school is the cookie cutter model. Homeschool is the special. Now, again, these are some of the famous people that have been successful in life and that have made their mark in life. And these are people that you would probably recognize their names. How many other people are successful in life? Now, about 3 million students, 3 million children are being homeschooled in the United States today. Parents fed up with the public school system, fed up with the crime, the drugs, and the and the mediocrity of public schools have taken the bull by the horns and have started to educate their children at home. Statistically, when we follow these homeschooled children, we find that they are better adjusted socially to society. They have less unemployment, not more. They are better educated, and you have a higher percentage of geniuses and people who are scholastic or academically oriented coming from homeschool environments than you do from public school. Now, that's not to say that you can't survive public school, but you will do better and you will survive better coming from homeschool on average. Now, let's take a look at spelling, for instance. Homeschoolers aren't immersed in a structured classroom setting amidst dozens of other students. Most of them don't even have credentialed teachers or state-approved curriculum. Most of the homeschooled students do not even have credentialed teachers. Mom and dad haven't even been to college. And here they are homeschooling their children. How do they do that? They do that because homeschool materials are out there everywhere. There are literally dozens of operations that put out, like the Bloomfield Education, or the Teaching Home, Homeschool Digest. These are publications to help people get into the homeschooling business and to pull their children out of public school into homeschooling and be successful in a homeschool environment. We'll take it up next time and we'll take a look at how do these homeschoolers actually compare when we put them out here in the competitive marketplace, such as in the spelling bees. How do homeschooled children fare in a spelling bee against parochial and public school children? Do they compete at all? Do they ever win the National Spelling Bee? We'll take a look at that next time. Meanwhile, I got to remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review that was sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.